Okay, when we last got together, our last class, we had just gotten up and finished chapter 4 in Ephesians, and tonight I want to start with chapter 5, but I want to sort of recap here, because while we're one chapter into the application section of Ephesians, it is so important that we never forget the continuity that goes throughout Ephesians. Remember that Paul sort of divides the book into two halves. The first three chapters are the theology, and the last three chapters are the application. And so, but these themes keep, you know, we have to keep remembering them. We have to keep seeing them because they're all, you know, this was, you know, Paul wrote this as one continuous thing. You know, it was just one continuous letter. And we come back now, and we divide it up in chapters and in verses, and, you know, we pick apart, you know, we'll spend a half hour discussing two verses and talking about the grammar and everything. But, you know, when Paul did this, it was a complete thing, you know, and so we always have to remember that it's always one whole thing. So, you know, the key then is you know, chapter 1, verses 3 through 14 are just, that's the foundational stuff. The work of the Father was to choose us and to give us an inheritance, right? To adopt us and to give us an inheritance. The work of the Son was to redeem us in His blood and to unite all people into one new body, a Jewish believer and Gentile believer, all into one body, Jew and Greek, no difference. The work of the Spirit was to seal us, to protect us, and to provide the down payment of that inheritance. And then Paul tells us that, you know, that's the critical work, that's the foundational work. And then he points out to us that we were all just a bunch of sinners. And we didn't deserve any of this, and we didn't get any of this by our own work, right? The grace through faith type of salvation was specifically so we couldn't boast, but the result of that was that now we are this new creation. We are the outworking of God's original plan, all that choosing and adopting and redeeming and sealing means that we now have this inheritance. And so there's no longer a difference between a Jewish believer or a Gentile believer. That we were all in the same mix, and now we're all in the same position again, and we're this brand new body. And that brand new body has it's a specific function, that we are the workmanship of God, and that we as a body, united in love together, show that work of God. We're that trophy, right? We're the, you know, I told somebody, I was describing this when I was teaching this before, that it's like the Stanley Cup. I don't know if y'all know hockey here. I like hockey. It's sort of my transition sport from the end of baseball to the beginning of spring training, you know, so hockey's out there. And Stanley Cup is the trophy that when you win the biggest game in hockey, when you're the number one team, the Stanley Cup. Stanley Cup's about 3 foot, 3.5 foot tall. It's really big. And at the end of the game, the winning team that wins the Stanley Cup, usually the captain of the team gets the cup, and he skates around the ice, and he holds it up above his head, this big trophy, and everybody sees it. Well, that's us. We're that trophy. Jesus is holding us up. God is showing us to be the trophy to all of creation to show his righteousness, his perfect love, and the work that he's done. That's what we are. That's our inheritance, and we are that trophy. And just like the Stanley Cup, interestingly enough, to make my analogy even better, is that, you know, the Stanley Cup started out literally being a little cup, right? Lord Stanley, and it was this little thing, and they engraved the names of the winners on it. Well, then pretty soon you ran out of room on this little bowl-like thing, and so they had to add, like, a piece to the bottom of it because they had to add more teams. Well, you know, hockey's been around for a long time. What started out as this little bowl thing is now 3.5 foot tall with names all over it and all around this big base. And that's kind of like us. You know, we started out with you know, God's salvation. He starts the church there in Acts 2. He started, you know, there at Pentecost. And as more names get added on, that trophy gets bigger. Well, we're God's trophy, so more names get added on. And so Paul says, you know, God has done this work, and Christ has made everybody into one united body, and that united body is the trophy, the thing that God shows to all creation to show his perfect righteousness and his perfect love. Okay, that's a speed reading through the first three books of Ephesians. Now, starting in 4, Paul says, okay, in light of all of that, knowing that all that stuff has been done for us as individuals, but for us as a collective entity, as a church, now we're to live in a certain way. You know, in light of this, you're to live. In a family relationship, as a child or as a spouse, when you know you're really loved, you don't go, oh great, I'm really loved back here, so now I'm going to go out and be this wild thing and disobey everybody. No, when you really know that you're loved within a family relationship, you're just so thankful for that, you just want to live in harmony with those people in your family. If you're a child, you want to obey your parent because you know you're really loved and cared for, and you don't want to do things. As a spouse, you want to help your spouse because you know you're really loved and you really care for them, so you want to do those things that are good. You don't want to say, well, heck with them, I'm going to go do my own thing here. So that sort of selfishness gets removed. Well, part of how we're to live is based on that love. We understand the immense love that God had for us to produce the situation that we're in, and so now we're going to live in light of that. And that's what Paul talks about starting in chapter 4. And I said that we can look at this. Paul uses this phrase, to walk, peripateo, the Greek verb there, and to walk. And Paul has all these different points where he talks about how we're to walk. And we understand that word walk to mean how to live. And we said that he started chapter 4, that we were to walk with the calling that we're called, there in verse 1 of chapter 4. That's the first time he uses it. And then he goes on to talk about what that looks like, how we're to do it. Then over in verse 17 of chapter 4, he talks now about that we're not to walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk. That's going to come up tonight when we look at chapter 5. That's his second use of the word walk. Okay. Tonight we're going to look at the third use of the word walk. We're to walk in love. Chapter 5, verse 2. So we're to walk in love. Paul will use that word walk again over in verse, the second half of verse 8 in chapter 5, where we're to walk in the light. He's going to use it a fifth time. Down in verse 15 of chapter 5, we're going to walk in wisdom. So Paul is telling us this is how we're to live. In light of all this stuff that's happened that God has done for it, this is how we have to live. And one of the keys about this is Paul is not providing, and I think this is really important. Paul could have said, okay, now here's how you're to live. You're to do these things with this frequency, in this manner, you know, which is normally how we approach our spiritual life. We want, especially nowadays, we seem to be, in everything, we seem to be obsessed with programs and how we do things, right? And a lot of folks approach, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, if you wanna, you know, quit smoking, you say, okay, there are certain things I need to do. You know, I'm going to do this on Monday, and then on Tuesday I'm going to do this. Exercise. You say, okay, I'm going to go to the gym 3 days a week, and I'm going to do these exercises for this amount of time. So programs are good in that respect. But there are times where they're not. Now, we're used to doing that in our spiritual life. We do a program, right? I'm going to read through the Bible. Our church is doing a thing. They read through the Bible in 90 days. It's absolutely wonderful. One of our church members he works for the district of the Evangelical Free Denomination. He's just this outstanding guy. He's a former pastor, just a great guy. And he's doing a blog every day, and he sort of recaps that portion that they've read. And I joked with him, in fact, that I didn't actually have to read the Bible in 90 days because I could just read his blog. And in about 4 paragraphs, I got, you know, a half hour's worth of reading. It's not true, but it is, and so we're doing that. But we think that, well, okay, well, if we do this for 90 days, that's going to make me somehow spiritually better. So here's an exercise program to be better spiritually. In the history of the church, you find this a lot. You know, Ignatius had his spiritual exercises, right? And there were certain things that you did. those who are monks who follow the rule of Saint Benedict, there are all these sort of things that you do. We do that nowadays as Christians, whether intentionally or unintentionally. We have certain things that we think we do. There are religious activities. You go to church a certain number of days in a row, or you pray a certain number of things, or I read these things, or we have these programs. It was real popular here several years ago, the Rick Warren thing, the 40 days of purpose. And so we have these things. What's fascinating to me is that's not what Paul does here. Okay, now Paul has some lists. We're going to look at these lists here in a minute. But Paul doesn't do that when he says, here's how I want you to live. He doesn't say, okay, now everybody, what I want you to do on Mondays and Wednesdays is you have to do this, and I want all the women to do this and all the men to do, there's no formula here. He doesn't say these are the prayers that you do every day. These are the activities. What Paul says is it's a change of heart. It's a change of mind that then produces the behavior. Paul says in chapter 4, as he's going through this, that if you're stealing, stop it. Use your hands for the good of others who might need something, right? Chapter 4, verses 28 and following. So there is as close as Paul gets to a program. But if you look at what he's saying, that's a very practical thing. If you're doing an activity, a behavior that's wrong, well, in light of what we know about what God has done in his love for us, then do that activity so that it benefits somebody, right? Because each activity will have a positive or negative effect, right? He says, quit lying. Well, what do? You speak the truth. It's very straightforward stuff. But all of this comes out of this idea that we've put on the new man, that there's a radical change on the inside of us that then produces these behaviors, okay? And that's what Paul's doing. And I think that's important for us to see, because here, where Paul has an opportunity to say, here's the program, he doesn't give us one. He talks about that radical change of heart and mind. It's so important. We're not saved. Lewis Sperry Schaefer comes up with this analogy. We're not saved by any work of our own, right? We're saved by the free gift of God, by grace through faith. It's not a work, so we don't boast. All of us, we have no problem with that. But then when it comes to our sanctification, we try to do it on our own work. And Lewis Sperry Schaefer has this wonderful little book on the Holy Spirit, talks about that we need to sort of apply that same idea to our sanctification. I don't rely on myself to save myself. Why should I rely on myself to sanctify myself? That's the work of the Holy Spirit. So we sort of reserve this idea of relying on God completely for one thing, but then we sort of say, okay, now that I'm there, God, I'll take over. I can do this. And we can't. You can't sanctify yourself. The whole idea that you even think that you need to sanctify yourself, you didn't come up with, right? That's the work of the Holy Spirit in convicting you, right? It's all this internal stuff. That's what Paul is doing here. It's this internal stuff. Now, why am I hammering away at this? Because this section that we're getting into here in chapter 5, people love to take this and get legalistic with it, okay? They love to take this and get legalistic with it. And you can't do that. Okay, that's not what Paul is doing here. It does not mean, and also then you get this false dichotomy gets created. Well, if you don't believe that Paul is saying, don't do these things or you won't go to heaven, well, then that must mean that it's okay to do those things. And that's not true. Paul always fought against this, our argument against the big fancy theological name is antinomianism. Okay, antinomianism means against the law. And Paul, throughout his writings, people would say, well, now, wait a minute, let me get this straight. We do this exact same thing today. We say, okay, let me get this straight. If I'm saved, and it's nothing that I've done, and once I'm saved, I'm always saved, then there's no reason at all for me to ever not sin. I can just go out and sin my socks off. Now, Paul was confronted with that when he said, where there's sin, there's a whole lot of grace. And the logical human idea then is, well, let's have more sin so we can have more grace, right? Which on paper doesn't sound too bad, right? But Paul says, no, that's not the case. You've got the right premise, but you've made the wrong conclusion. So we still do that today. We say, but wait a minute, if this isn't a list of things that we're going to look at that says you can't go to heaven if you do this, and it proves you're not a believer in all this stuff, then that means that all this stuff isn't right. And we're not really saying, well, that's not what Paul is saying. Okay, Paul is saying it's part of the radical change that's internal that produces the behavior that we do, that we then walk in these certain ways. Okay, so I'm trying to lay some groundwork here for this. Okay, so we start chapter 5, verse 1. Therefore, be imitators of God as dear children. That word therefore is there. Again, if you're looking at your Greek text, it's that word un. And we know that always points back to it references something Paul has said. In this case, I think it points all the way back to the beginning of this section. I think it points all the way back to chapter 4, verse 1. I think Paul is saying everything in chapter 4. In light of everything that I've said in chapter 4, be imitators of God as his beloved children. I think, though, in the commentary, the Ephesians commentary that we're using, Honer, I think also says that he's specifically pointing back to what Paul is talking about in 4:17. And if you look at what Paul says in 4:17, he says, "This I say therefore and testify in the Lord that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind." What Paul is saying here is that in light of everything I said in chapter 4, and I think particularly this idea of not walking like the Gentiles, this is how we're to live. What are we to do? Well, he says it in verse 2, "And walk in love, as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma." So Paul makes his statement here that in light of everything in chapter 4 that we said, right, about how we're to be humble and loving and united together, and that we're not to be like the Gentiles, those who, and in this case it would be as unbelievers, then what do we do? We're to walk in love. Okay? Here we have that word walk again, and again, it doesn't mean to just walk. It means to live. That's how we live. And if you think about it, it's not just, you know, that word live, you know, there's live, there's, you know, make sure your heart's beating and your blood's flowing and your lungs are working, that's live, right? But live in this context means it's our paradigm, right? It's how we view the world. You know, I wear glasses. Everybody in the room right now that I'm looking at has glasses on. If I take my glasses off, suddenly you are all very blurry. And I must say, all the guys look a lot better. My wife and I joke that God's way of blessing our marriage is that we both need glasses to see real well, that when we take them off, we are just as handsome and beautiful as the day we got married. But my glasses are the thing that I rely on to be able to see and to understand. I mean, you know, because I a huge amount of my input is visual, right? When I take my glasses off, I lose a huge amount of input. So I'm not, well, that's the paradigm. When Paul says we're to live, walk about in love, we're to live in love, he's saying that the glasses that we wear, that's what he's saying. That's we're to live in love, right? We're to live in wisdom. We're to live not as the Gentiles. We're to live in unity. That's the paradigm, okay? That the answer to the questions, even the questions that I would ask, are all driven by that paradigm: love, wisdom, unity. Okay? So when he says live in love, he means that we focus our day, our choices we make, what we choose to do, what we choose to avoid, our actions, our responses, are filtered through this paradigm, through those glasses, right? And it's unity, it's love, it's wisdom, okay? That's what this live, walk about means, okay? So he says we're to be imitators of God as beloved children. In other words, the analogy there is that you know, kids that know, well, I just said it a little bit ago, you know, in a family situation, children that know that they're loved, children that know that they're cared for and safe, they're going to live in a certain manner. Children that are fearful, children that know they're not loved, children that do not live in a safe environment, that do not have that connection, I mean, it's just sociological. You can see the proof there. Those are kids that get themselves into trouble, right? So we're God's children. Remember the adoption motif, not just motif. It literally says in chapter 1 that we're adopted as sonship. So we are loved children. God loves us. He is the perfectly loving, righteous Father. So we're to act out of that position of safety and knowledge and freedom. So we're to act, and the way we do that is to walk in love. Now, this really points back, this idea of walking in love. If you go back to, and I made a big deal out of this at the time, chapter 1, verse 4, talking about the work of God, just as He chose us in Him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and without blame before Him in love. That's the same in love, okay? That's the same word, agape, and agape, same prepositional phrase there. I said at the time that we're to be holy and blameless in His sight in love meant that as a group, as the church, as all believers together, that in love is a corporate concept, and that's how we appear before God. That's the same thing He's telling us here, that we are to walk in love. We are to be unified as a group. And it's not that, you know, picking daisies, singing, running through the meadow, I'm in love kind of stuff. It's not romantic love. It's not goofy, giddy, I'm just happy kind of love. But it's that honest bond that we have within the church. It's the love that we have for each other as fellow believers. You know, it's realistic, it's truthful. It means that if you're a knucklehead, you know, your brothers or sisters are going to tell you, you're being a knucklehead, you need to pull back. It's a love that says, I'm uncomfortable with that other person, but you know, that person is a fellow believer and a fellow child of God, and so whatever I'm uncomfortable with, I have to put aside or work through, because it's not the way the world works, that we simply like those who like us, or we like those who look like us, or whatever reason. So this concept of in love is a corporate idea. It's a unifying idea. Points back exactly to what was being said there in verse 1. And now he gives us, Paul now in the second half of verse 2 here, gives us the manner or the way that we're to walk in love. We're to walk in love as Christ also has loved us and given Himself for us. The Greek text there in verse 2, he says we're to walk in love. He has this phrase, kathos kai. Now, when you see kathos and kai together, you get this, it's the idea of a comparative relationship, okay? Another way to translate that, you would say, and walk in love just as Christ has also love, right? So just in the same way that Christ loves. It's making a comparison. It's saying, I want you guys to be like Christ. And then he says, how did that happen? How did Christ exhibit His love? Well, Christ exhibited His love by He gave Himself for us. Now, it's interesting here that this is, this exact same phrase comes up over here a little bit later in chapter 5. Over in verse 25, Paul is telling husbands how they're to deal with their wives. And he says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself for her. See, this model of Christ as giving Himself for the church is the model of how we're to love. Okay? And we'll see this when we get over to it here in a couple weeks. It's this concept of mutual submission. For me to exhibit my love for my spouse or for other believers is in a sacrificial way. I sacrifice my interest so that I can do what's good for the other person. Okay? I would rather be sitting at home on my couch watching the baseball game on TV this evening, given an ideal situation. But it's important for me to come down here and teach what God said in the Bible. you guys would rather be any number of places, but it's important for you to come and learn what God has said in the Word, okay? We gather together as a church, not for our own interest, but to say what is good for the body. All, as believers now, we're equipped and we're better. We go out there and we avoid the winds and tossings and turnings that Paul talks about of false doctrine because we've studied God's Word. And so all of this stuff that we do, I would do something for a fellow believer to help him out or to do something for his betterment, just like I would expect other believers to do things for my betterment and my good, because that's the kind of thing. We're all modeled on this view of how Christ has given himself for the church. And Paul talks about it here for everybody. He talks about it specifically in verse 25 as an example for how husbands are to love their wives. So Paul says that we're to walk in love just like, we're to do it exactly like a Christ loved us. How did he do that? He gave himself on behalf of us. Now this is interesting. Paul adds this phrase, as an offering and a sacrifice to God for an odor of fragrance, for a pleasant aroma. I think that what he's doing there is Paul is particularly pointing to how Christ's death on the cross fulfilled the sacrificial system of the law. So what's going on here is it's not just a larger philosophical concept that we're to, the love of our brother and sisters, and certainly that's part of it, and we're to love each other in the way that Christ has loved us, but specifically the monumental thing about Christ's love for us was his sacrificial death, which fulfilled the sacrifices required under the law. And that's hugely important, okay? Because it takes it from being one of these sort of touchy-feely psychological ideas to very practical application. Christ fulfilled the requirements of the law for us. That was his sacrifice. We are to fulfill the law of Christ by our love for each other and our behavior, which is how we are presented blameless and holy in front of God in love. So it all ties together. But I think that Paul is specifically, when he's talking about, when he uses these two words, offering and sacrifice, and he uses this idea of a fragrant aroma, I think Paul is particularly pointing to the fulfillment of the requirements of the law, the sacrifice of the law, and to the temple practice. Now, the Jewish believers in the crowd would get that very easily. I think most of the Gentile believers would as well, because it wasn't like this was a big mystery what they were doing over there in downtown Jerusalem, Gentiles couldn't get into the joint, but they knew what was going on. I mean, there's no way you can be burning bulls and lambs and everything daily on a big barbecue and not have folks walking by outside going, whoa, it's like living next to a black Angus, you're gonna smell that. So. And it wasn't like the way the LDS Church keeps their temple practice secret today. Nobody other than an official, a good standing Mormon knows what's said and goes on in the temple. It's not like that. Gentiles couldn't do it, but it wasn't a secret to anybody. So I think that everybody would have gotten this. It's an important point for us to realize that Christ, and we say this, but I don't think we always get it. Christ died for our sins. He offered the complete sacrifice on the cross. Christ fulfilled the Old Testament, the regulations of the law. Okay, Christ did that. And when he fulfilled that, it means we don't have to do it anymore. Okay? Hebrews is very straight. In Hebrews chapter 10, it says no sacrifice remains. Okay, now it doesn't mean, as some people take that passage to say, well, if I sin after I'm a believer, I'm doomed. No, what it means is that we don't do Yom Kippur anymore. We don't have that. We don't have to go in. In fact, he even says that in Ephesians, or in Hebrews when you read this. He likens Christ to the high priest. He says every year the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. He offers sacrifice. He says the sacred name of God. And God then puts away the sins for a whole year. But then next year, the guy's got to go back in there again, right? Every year he's got to do that. And it says that in Hebrews. And so what the author of Hebrews says is that Jesus did that once and for all. He was that high priest. He offered that sacrifice, and now he's done. And he even says he sat down. High priest stood up. He sat down. And he says, no sacrifice remains, meaning we don't have to do that sacrifice anymore. That's what Paul means here. Jesus as an offering and a sacrifice as a fragrant aroma to God. That sacrifice is done. Okay, there is no more sacrifice that we have to do. Right. I always say that there should never be an altar in a Christian church. Okay, because an altar is a place of sacrifice, and there is no sacrifice in the Christian church, so you should never have an altar in a Christian church. You can have the Lord's Supper table, that's great. You can have a little place to put flowers, that's wonderful. Your little Advent wreath at Christmas, but it's not an altar, because we don't do a sacrifice. That's where I strongly differ, by the way, with our Roman Catholic friends, who teach that at the altar, the priest offers a sacrifice which is the reenactment of the sacrifice of Christ every day. And to me, that's completely outside of what the Bible teaches here. Okay, so this sacrifice, then, as believers, we don't offer sacrifice anymore. What we do is we sacrifice ourselves for others. That's completely different. I don't sacrifice my desires and my personal intention for the other guys in the men's group at my church because I'm trying to atone for anything. What I'm doing is I'm sacrificing my personal desire out of love for their betterment. So it's a relationship of mutual submission, not one of atonement. Christ did the atonement, but we're to sacrifice ourselves for each other in that same manner, but not to atone. I don't do a penance to take away my sin. I don't need to. Christ already done that. I may do a penance. I may mortify myself in some way, fast or deny myself something or be strict with myself in a physical way or something because I'm trying to conform myself or break myself of a habit or something. But it's not for atonement. What Paul is saying here is we're to be like Christ. He's atoned for us. We sacrifice, but we sacrifice out of mutual submission. Yeah, question.
Oh, I was going to say, the scripture talks about we offer the sacrifice of praise.
Right.
That's what, if anything, you know, I mean, it's not to get us something.
Right.
But it's you know what I'm
right.
It's not to get us anything, but it's like, you know, sometimes you don't feel like praising God, and he requests that you give a praise. Even if you don't feel like it,
right.
You know, or whatever,
right.
And it's all based on the work that he's done, that Christ has done on the cross, in terms of him sacrificing himself for our sins.
Right, exactly. We offer worship.
Right.
We're not trying to redeem ourselves. We are already redeemed. What we offer is either mutual submission within each other, or worship to God. And it's not that we choose to offer it. It's ultimately demanded by the nature of God. Everything worships God. We're lucky. We're free to do that. We can come to Him with joy and say, I just want to worship you. Not everybody does that, but that'll be taken care of eventually. Everybody's going to worship God. But yeah, that's exactly the point there. So then we see Paul uses at the end of verse 2 these ideas of an offering, sacrifice, a fragrant aroma. He's saying that Christ's sacrifice was the final atonement. It fulfilled that Old Testament, but that we are to walk in love, sacrifice for each other in a mutually submissive concept, a mutual submission in the way that Christ did. That's our model. Now, this section in chapter 5, it offers sort of a positive and a negative thing. The positive is these first two verses. Then Paul offers, and he's done this throughout the book. I mean, we saw that throughout 4. He had positive, negative. Now the negative here, Paul is going to give a list of what it looks like to not live that way. Okay? What it looks like to not walk in love. But Paul does this, again, not as a, this is not legalism. This isn't a list of what to avoid, although you would do well to avoid all these things we're going to talk about. But that's not Paul's purpose. Paul's purpose now is to say, okay, what does this look like? How do we live in light of everything that we know from the first 3 chapters of this book? How do we live our life? Well, we're to walk in love just as Christ. Okay, but how does that look? Paul is putting meat on it here. He's given the application. And so starting in verse 3, chapter 5, Paul is going to give us a list of thou shalt nots. Okay? but it's important to see how he's doing this. He says here at verse 3, "But fornication and all uncleanliness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you, as is fitting for saints. For neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather give thanks." Okay, so Paul says, here's what we can't be doing. Okay, fornication. That's just all manner of sexual uncleanliness. Okay, folks like to parse this thing out, and they like to say, well, it means this, this, or this, or it only means this and not this. If we look at these words here, if we look at this that we should avoid fornication, that is talking more often than not in the Koine literature, that's describing prostitution or homosexuality. Those are usually the primary times we see this. But it also has to do with, when it's used in the Koine literature, it has to do with avoiding other non-marital sexual experiences. Okay, so it really is a fairly broad thing. It's, you know, boy, the Christian church is so weird about sex. I'm sure they're going to edit this part of the tape anyway, just because I said the word. No, they won't. They're very liberal here at Hadavar. But we are so weird about that, and it's because the church has been just against sex from the minute it shifted from being a primarily a Jewish organization to being a Greek one. I mean, just from the very beginning, they've had this anti-sex thing going on. And the Bible is the least anti-sex book you can find. Okay, there is an entire book of the Bible that tells you that you should just absolutely have a blast within your marriage when it comes to enjoying the physical pleasure you and your partner can have. And I refuse to teach that book to a mixed class, because when you read the Hebrew text there, what it says, it is really explicit. Okay, not in an obscene manner, but it's very explicit about physical love. And I'm uncomfortable doing that with women in the room. So I always say, I'm not going to teach that to... They tried to get me to do that at my home church, and I said I wouldn't do it. I'll do it for the guys, but I won't do it for the ladies, because it makes me very nervous. And it's clear, Paul even says, you know, that married people are not to deny each other except for particular reasons. That this is a gift of God. This is one of the wonderful things God has given us. But yet what we do as humans, right, we take that thing that's good and we pervert it. We just mess around with it, right? And so, but what happens, what we do, is you know, and I love this. Now, young guys do this a lot. You talk to high school guys, talk to college guys. They like to do this a lot. The girls, not so much. I think it's because guys are a little bit stranger in this area. But they say, okay, they don't ask, how can I be holy? They say, what can I get away with, right? And when it comes to this area. Well, what Paul is saying here is, yeah, I know this normally, this word, we find it in the literature reserved for prostitution or homosexuality, but really, Paul's usage here, it's for all non-married sexual encounters, okay? But Paul makes sure that we don't just say, okay, well, I could get away with this, but not this, because the next word there that he uses is... all uncleanliness. And in fact, even he adds this word pasa, which is the word all, to mean it's all encompassing. So it's not just these two or three sexual sins, but it's all uncleanliness. And if you think about it, that's everything. Okay, it's not just well, okay, sex is bad, but I can do these other things. No, I think that Paul is talking about all uncleanliness, all of those things that we physically do that aren't glorifying God or realizing the beauty of the gift of our human body. Okay, so, you know, I think this would include, although Paul doesn't specifically say it, he talks about it later, I think this would include abuse of our bodies in terms of, you know, chemical abuse. Right, drinking, use of illicit drugs, you know, those kind of things. Putting ourselves in a way that would damage and harm our bodies. You know, jumping off of buildings with a parachute on your back. You know, those kind of things. That this idea is, it encompasses beyond just the sexual things. I think all of this. But clearly Paul is talking about the sexual uncleanliness that was common in that society of that day. Okay? It's common in that day. And so he's talking about that. And then he says, the next thing is fornication, all uncleanliness, or covetousness, greed. Okay, that word there that the New King James says covetousness, it's the word greed. We're not to be greedy. So we're not to be sinning with our body, right? Sexual sin, all uncleanliness, but also greed. That's an internal thing. Okay, greed may result in us stealing something, but greed is an internal thing. Greed is a heart thing. It's a head thing, right? I'm greedy. I want more of this. I want what that guy has. I'm angry that I don't have, right? So in this very short thing of three words, Paul covers all of this negative stuff, right? So he says, but fornication, all uncleanliness, all greed, let it not even be named among you as is fitting for the saints. In other words, this shouldn't even be on the table for us. Okay? You know, there are some people that I meet, there are some people in my family that are just such men, that are just such godly men. My brother-in-laws, my son, are such godly men that those guys don't even think of some of the stuff that you could possibly try to do that's negative. It's not even on the page for them, right? And that's what Paul is saying. We should be so much walking in love, so close to God, that we don't even think, oh, that's an option. Nah, I shouldn't do it. You know, that the that's an option idea shouldn't even come up, okay? And then, so he says that, and then he then adds this next part, neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather give thanks. Honer particularly translates that well. And before we take our break, I'll just read Honer's translation of that. He says, and let there be no obscenity and foolish talk nor sarcastic ridicule, which are inappropriate, but rather thanksgiving. I love that translation. Okay, let's go ahead then we'll take our break and we'll come back and we'll pull that apart and we'll look at the rest of this passage in 5.
Okay.
Okay, so this translation that Honer has said of verse 4, I really like. And let there be no obscenity and foolish talk, nor sarcastic ridicule, which are inappropriate, but rather thanksgiving. Okay, the big point here is that Paul is doing the same thing that he did with the stealing. If you steal, quit stealing, use your hands to do good. If you're using this bad speech, stop it, use your speech to give thanksgiving. Okay, so Paul is doing this. Quit doing this. Do this. Why? Because you've had this internal change. But what I like about Honer's translation is the normal one that we get is real similar, the New King James here, that says neither filthiness nor foolish talk nor coarse jesting. Well, you know, again, we get into this legalism thing. And what we get is this idea that somehow Christians should just be the sour, straight-faced people who have no sense of humor, and you can't say anything that's not, you know, just this milquetoast vanilla language. And that's not what Paul is saying here. You know, Paul told us that it's okay to be angry, but you have to be angry within control, right? Because he said, don't let the sun go down your anger, give the devil a chance to work. But he doesn't say don't be angry, right? Here, Paul's not saying don't crack jokes. Don't kind of rib your buddies occasionally. You know, if somebody comes in with a goofy pair of shoes, go, wow, that's a goofy pair of shoes. That's not what Paul is telling us to not do. What Paul is telling us not to do is what I think Honer says here, don't be obscene. You know, as believers, we should not be obscene. I always tell this story about my wife. Now, my wife is just awesome. I've said that before, even with the mic off. I have this awesome wife. And the thing about Libby is that she's not... You don't see her and you think, oh, there's a prude, there's this uptight Christian woman. What you see is somebody that you're uncomfortable when you're getting out of bounds around. And in her work environment, people have been uncomfortable, you know, being obscene and dropping obscene words in meetings and being coarse because she's in the room. And that's a good thing. That's, I think, a very positive witness. It's not that she sits there and sets herself up as the queen of all that's prim and proper, but people recognize in her, here's this good, honest woman. I'm really uncomfortable being out of bounds around her. And I think what he's saying, Paul's saying, we shouldn't be obscene. As believers, that gives no good witness at all. If I'm out there seeing the most obscene jokes that we'd hear on TV or in the radio, or if I'm, you know, dropping F-bombs in every other phrase like the latest rap artist is, you know, or I'm being derogatory towards women, that doesn't say anything different about me. That's not showing you that I walk in love. That's not showing you that I believe that we should be in relationships of mutual submission and in caring, and right? That's saying I'm just like everybody else. But it's not saying, you know, we have to be, I have to parse everything I say. You know, the Bible contains cuss words. I always say that, you know, Paul says we shouldn't be obscene. Right, I shouldn't be out there telling dirty jokes and using obscene speech. But the Bible has profanity in it. Paul says over in Galatians when he's in Philippians when he's talking about you know, all these wonderful things that Paul has in his life. He's a rabbi and he's you know, circumcised at the right time. He's this great, you know, leader, this great man. But all of that counts as nothing. Well, that word there we get in our translations as dross or as dung. Well, Paul uses a Greek cuss word there. In other words, whenever I've taught that passage, I can't actually translate that into its English equivalent because it was a colloquialism for dog poop, okay? And Paul is very specific there. So the Holy Spirit seemed to be okay with that in the New Testament. Let Paul have that. Paul says he's very angry at the folks in Galatia who are trying to teach a Gentile believers that you have to be Jewish, right, to be a believer, and that you have to practice circumcision. And what does Paul say? Paul does not mince words. Paul says, I hope those guys, the knife slips, right? Paul says, I hope you emasculate yourself, right? Well, you know, that's a pretty earthy thing to say. Paul refers to his enemies as dogs. Well, in the Middle East and in that time, when you referred to somebody as a dog, that was really bad, right? Because that was like the lowest of low. So this idea of obscene speech is not necessarily saying we can't be angry and show our frustration, but we can't stand around and talk like we're in the gutter, like the way non-believers are comfortable with. And then this idea that foolish talk or sarcastic ridicule. You know, there's nothing wrong with teasing your buddies. Trust me, the group of guys that I'm on the worship team with over at my home church is a wonderful group of incredibly godly men. But, you know, we tease the socks off each other frequently because that's just kind of how we are. That's the camaraderie we have. But this sarcastic ridicule means that there's a point that I can't belittle another believer. I can't cut them down with these words. So this idea that we can't tell a joke or we have to be careful of the language we use or this stuff, that's not what Paul is saying here. What Paul is saying is don't be obscene. Don't in your language mimic those who are doing those sexual obscenities that I just counseled you against. Don't in your language cut each other down in a way that's not showing your mutual love. So Paul tells us that these fornication, uncleanliness, and greed we can't do. We're not to have obscene language or foolish talk or sarcastic ridicule. That instead we're to give thanks. We're to use our words in the proper way. And then he says, so why is this? The reason why he's telling everybody this. He says, starting in verse 5, for this you know, that no fornicator, unclean person, nor covetous man. That's the exact same order as those same things he presented in verse 3. Fornication, uncleanliness, and greed. Here in verse 5, for you know that no fornicator, unclean person, nor greedy man. Notice here he adds, who is an idolater has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. In other words, the reason why we don't do this stuff is that the folks who God brings his wrath onto, the things that God doesn't like, the people that do the stuff that makes God angry, does these things. So we're not to do that. Now he added, Paul added here this after greedy, the greedy man, who's an idolater. Idolatry has I think idolatry is the root of all of these things. Sexual sin, greed, uncleanliness, all of that is idolatry. What it means is that we put our view or our desire or our need ahead of God's. But I think particularly here, he's pointing over to this idea back in Romans. We talk about that God has told us or taught us about himself in two ways. His revelation comes in two flavors. There's general revelation and there's special revelation. Special revelation is Jesus. Special revelation is the Bible, okay? It's particular, it leads to salvation. General revelation is the general presentation of God within all of creation. And over in Romans 1, Paul talks about that. He talks that he explains that God has shown it already for verse 20 here in chapter 1 of Romans. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they were without excuse. In other words, we can know about God from his creation. Which makes sense. I mean, my goodness, I just spent a lot of time up in the Eastern Sierras while we were on our break. It is impossible not to stand in these incredible vistas up in the mountains and just not be overwhelmed by God. You know, even in knowing that creation's fallen, it's still astoundingly beautiful, right? And so, you know, we know, Romans tells us, and that's what we call general revelation. Well, look what happens. Look where the sin comes in here. Romans, starting in 24, chapter 1. Therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanliness. Okay, these folks that didn't recognize God in creation. Gave them up to uncleanliness and the lust of their hearts, the dishonor of their bodies among themselves. And here's how they got themselves in trouble. They exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. So in other words, instead of worshiping the creation, they said, oh, I'm going to worship that tree. Or I'm going to worship this desire that I have. Or I'm going to worship this feeling or this thing. They worship the creation for the creator. Well, that's that's part of the greed. This goes over into when religion goes over into magic, right? You know that and we do this. Christians do this too. This is all religions have this. Religion is the practice of these spiritual things and whatnot. But when you start to now, you quit worshiping God, and you start to manipulate him. You say, okay, I'm. You know, you find John 1, chapter 5, about how we know that we can be in God's will and get exactly what we want. So we get this formula of how to pray so that God meets our needs, right? We give a certain amount to whatever TV preacher, and we know that we're going to get 100-fold of that, right? And so that's magic. That's not religion. That's magic. That's saying, I do these things, that manipulates, now God has to do this. We find some religions have a lot more magic in them than they do regular religious things. The Vedic tradition, Hinduism and whatnot, has a tremendous amount of those sort of things in it, other than its philosophical and its religious things. We do that in Christianity. You know, there was years ago, there was this whole thing of how to pray. So you got exactly, you know, what you needed, you know, and you wrote it down on a little piece of paper and you stuck it on your mirror and you had certain formulas. That's magic. That's not religion. So I think this idea, it comes from Greek. This idea of worshiping the creature, not the creator. That's this thing. That's this idolatry. That's what Paul is talking about here back in 5, in verse 6, where he's talking about the covetous man is the idolater. And then he says, going on in verse 6 here in Ephesians 5, let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, the fornication, the uncleanliness, the greed, because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be partakers with them. Okay, you who were once in darkness, but now are in the light of the Lord, walk as children of the light. Okay, so what's Paul saying? He says, look, there's all this stuff out there going on. Okay, there's fornication, there's uncleanliness, there's greed, there's external stuff, there's internal stuff of the mind and the heart, right? There's all this stuff going on. You guys are believers. You have this inheritance. You are the adopted children of God. You have this eternal inheritance. Why in the world do you want to go out there and do the exact same thing as these people that you know God gets angry when they do that and he's going to condemn? Why in the world would you do that? Why would you? That's not how you're to walk, right? And he points that out. He says, look, don't be mistaken here. The people that do these things, and he calls them the sons of disobedience. Okay? Remember back in, go back to chapter 2, verse 2. Paul is telling us what we were like before we were saved. He says in chapter 2, "And he made alive those who were dead in trespasses and sin, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince and power of the air and the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience." It's the same word here, sons of disobedience. Those are the folks who are not saved, okay? Those are the ones who are going against God, okay? And Paul is saying, look at the sons of disobedience, these unsaved people, the ones that are going against God, they're doing these things. Why would you even want to do them when you know that they're going to be condemned for it? Why do you want to act in that way? You see, what Paul is saying here, it's not that here's a list of things that you have to, that you can't do, because if you do them, well, you're not going to go to heaven. That's not what he's saying at all. That would directly conflict with chapter 2, verses 8 through 10. Okay? Because if I say that if I don't do something, I save myself, I keep from losing my salvation, then that means I have control of my salvation, right? Mm-hmm. Chapter 2, verses 8 through 10 tells us that we don't. We're not saved by ourselves. It's no work. God saves us. We don't save ourselves. So, if I say, well, if by doing something or not doing something, I can lose my salvation, then that means that I saved myself, right? Because if I say that if I play cards, I lose my salvation, then if I avoid playing cards, I've saved myself, right? You see the logic there, right? But yet if I can save myself, then Ephesians 2, 8, and 10 are wrong. Because there it says that we're saved by grace through faith, and it's not a work, right? It's God's gift. So what Paul is saying here is this is... Now, he's not saying to do these things. Oh, sure, go out and fornicate and be unclean and be greedy. That's okay, because you're assured of your salvation. He's not saying that. He's saying, why in the world would you even want to do that? Because the people that do it are the folks that aren't saved. You guys are saved. You're God's children. Now, Paul uses a real interesting word here. Paul says in verse 7, therefore do not be sharers with them. Do not be participants with them. Okay? Do not be partakers with them. That word, partakers or share or participant, means that you've now become one with them. You've yoked yourself with them. You are now part of their group. Okay? And Paul says, don't do that. Don't be part of the group of these people that are doing things that makes God angry. These unbelievers, don't yoke yourself with unbelievers. Now, why do I know that Paul means that strongly? Because if we go back to chapter 3, right, and or I'm sorry, chapter 2, Paul is talking about the mystery of the church. No, it is chapter 3, I'm sorry. Chapter 3, verse 6. Paul is talking about the mystery of the church. What's the mystery of the church? It's the whole basis of his ministry. That the Gentiles should be fellow heirs... that the Gentiles should be fellow heirs of the same body and partakers of his promise in Christ through the gospel. That's the same word, partakers. This one body that Jesus has made of Jewish believers and Gentile believers, this one body means that Gentiles now are partakers of the promises of Abraham. Okay? They are partakers, they're participants, they're sharers. That's the exact same word in the negative sense that Paul uses over here in 5, where he says, we are not to be partners or partakers or sharers with these sons of disobedience. Okay? In other words, it's not that we're not to do these sins because we're going to lose our salvation. Okay? We're not to do these sins because this is how people who are against God act. And why would those of us who are God's adopted children who have this eternal inheritance, why would we act in that way? So I started tonight talking about this idea that this is not, it's not a prescription, it's not a legalist idea, it's not a list of things that I'm not to do in order to be religious it's this internal attitude. Why would I do these things that I know so grossly offend God and these people who are not believers? Why as a believer would I want to link myself with them and do that? You see the difference there? The outcome is the same, that we don't do that stuff. Right, we don't fornicate, we're not unclean, and we're not greedy, okay? We're not to do that stuff. But it's different. It's not that we don't do it because we're going to be punished. It's that we do it because there's this internal change. We are a new man. We are believers. We have an inheritance. We don't do this stuff because that's what the people that don't have the inheritance do. And why would I act that way? You know, people that have dealt with addictions, you know, an alcoholic sits there after he's been clean and sober for years and says, why would I go sit at that bar, be with all these drunk people? Why would I do that? That's not a part of my life anymore. Or criminal behavior, guys that were in gangs. Why would I go hang out on the front porch down in Willowbrook with the other guys in the gang? That's not my life anymore. That's why would I do that? And that's what Paul is saying here. Why would we as believers do any of these things that the unbelievers are doing that we know God is going to bring his wrath down on them for? Why would I do that? I wouldn't do that. I love God. I've got this inheritance, so I'm not going to act in that way anymore. It's not fear of punishment. It's that internal change of heart, that love of God. It's the same reason why we love each other. Not because we're forced to, not because I have to, not because I particularly like that person because they're just like me and they agree 100% with me or they're nice to me. We do it because we're all believers. And so that's what Paul is stressing here. Now, we're going to end at this point tonight. There is some discussion as to where Paul makes the break, whether he makes his break at the end of verse 8, sort of the end of verse 8, or whether he makes his break at verse 7. I clearly am taking it through verse 8, where I take my break. I'm in disagreement with Honer in his commentary on this point, but we'll sort of touch on that next week on this. But the main point of what Paul was saying here then is there's all this activity that as believers we shouldn't do, not because of punishment, not because of fear, but we shouldn't do it because that's yoking ourselves with unbelievers. Unbelievers are doing it and they're going to get God's wrath. We shouldn't act like unbelievers because we're not. We're believers. We have this eternal inheritance. Okay, I'll see everybody next week.
All right. Next week, could you talk about...